6. Still Crazy After All These Years, 1995-2002. It had been something of a Saturday night massacre. Lorne Michaels was forced to fire Adam Sandler and Chris Farley. He was ordered to fire Tim Meadows, too, but managed to stay that execution. Veteran Jim Downey was ousted as head writer. Mike Myers had gone to Hollywood to make movies and money. Saturday Night Live probably had nowhere to go but up, back up, rebounding as it had done so many times before. It didn't hurt that the likes of Will Ferrell, Sherry O'Terry, Daryl Hammond, Chris Kattan, Jimmy Fallon, Anna Gasteyer, Tracy Morgan, Molly Shannon, Horatio Sanz, and Tina Fey were waiting in the wings. Alec Baldwin, host. Some of the cast members and writers leave the show and do things that are elevated compared to what they're asked to do on the show, but many of them, this is a terrible thing to say, leave there and become the very thing they made fun of on the show. One of the oddest elements of the show is that you're standing next to some guy one day doing the show and you think that they're funny, but you turn around and 5 years later they're getting paid $20 million a movie. There are people I worked with there who I never thought in my wildest dreams that they'd go on to become the apotheosis of movie comedy of their day. So now, I'm nice to everybody on the show. No matter who I work with, no matter what a sniveling, drooling wuss they are, I embrace them all like they're my dearest friend and my most respected colleague. Robert Wright, NBC Chairman and CEO. I haven't made that many trips to the 17th floor. As a matter of fact, my one official trip to the 17th floor, I don't remember the date, was when we had gone through a painful period of recasting, and it was the only time that I was really involved in it. Lorne was really being very good to me. He was humoring me along all the way. He was sending me audition tapes. I was getting really nervous that we were going to do something dumb, that there was so much pressure on Lorne that he would do something that he didn't want to do, because he thought the company wanted him to do it. I was saying to myself, I've seen this show probably more than anybody at NBC has. I know what's funny on this show and what isn't funny. I really felt that way. So he was sending me tapes that summer, and then when the cast was picked and I was in complete agreement with the people he'd picked, I marched up to the 17th floor. Maybe it was just before the season began or just after. And I remember the cast then was Chris Farley, Will Ferrell, Molly Shannon, Chris Kattan just arrived, and Anna and Sherry. I had seen all their tapes, so you kind of feel like you know these people. They didn't know me, but I'd seen their tapes. So I go up there, and I'm very friendly and everything. Hi, how you doing? And, whoop, they were standing there. Lorne had them all lined up. It was like a wedding, but there were no other people at the wedding except us and Lorne. And they were just like, Hi. All of a sudden it wasn't cozy at all. And Lorne would say, No, you can talk. You can talk to him. And to me, you can talk to them. So it took a while. We were there about 15 minutes, and I said, Well, why don't you just tell me how you feel about being on the show? And Lorne is going, Tell him what you really think. Go ahead, you can say things. I said to Lorne afterward, I don't think this is really a good idea, Lorne. He said, I don't know why they did that. They're very comfortable and everything. They're very happy. Lorne Michaels, executive producer. I can be pretty savage about people here in terms of what I think their flaws are. I can get abusive. I don't think that what I do between dress and air is terribly nurturing. It's more military, like a drill. My notes tend to be to the point. I think there's a real toughness with people who are funny in the way they've developed their own armor, but some of the people here are made of glass. They can be just very insensitive to other people, and at the same time, if you pointed out the same thing to them, most of them would be surprised or hurt. It takes me a long time to understand why I don't like people. I think it's a problem I haven't solved. The idea that people are dumb or not interested always comes as a surprise to me. I always thought I could talk to just about anybody and make myself understood. And when you realize that isn't the case, that either they don't get it or have no interest in it, it takes me a long time to figure that out, because I go, Why would you be here? Why would you pick this place to want to work? Steve Higgins, producer. We hear that "it isn't as good as it used to be" thing constantly. I think it probably started on show 2 in 1975. It's a matter of time before we're going to read Saturday Night Dead in the papers again. A funny thing happened when I got here. Lorne mapped the whole thing out. He told me, "Here's what's going to happen. Olmeyer's going to be gone. He's giving us grief now, but he's going to be gone. And somebody else will come in, and by that time the show will be at its height again. But then, 2 years later, it'll come down again because the avalanche will start. You'll see Saturday Night Dead. We'll see that for a while, and then it'll be, 'The show is funnier than it's ever been.' And then it'll be, 'The show is worse than it's ever been.' And it's worked out exactly like that. And you go, okay, if you're caught up in this historical cycle, you just try to stave off that 'the show's not as funny' crap. And the thing is, you wouldn't go to a carpenter's house and go, 'Wow, what a crappy job you did on your shelves,' or say to a doctor, 'How many patients have you killed?' But people feel free to comment in ways that make you go, 'Where do you think you get the nerve?' I think they own the show. You know what? If you like everything in the show, then that's not a good show. If you love every single thing, there's something wrong. It's like pushing the envelope, which is a horrible term, but it's about making that tent big enough so that everybody's included, so that there's something for everybody in the show. You should like most of it, but there might be some performance piece that you go, 'I just don't get that.' And it killed, and the audience loves it, and you go, 'I guess that worked.' And that's one thing that Lorne is good at. He'll put enough in that there's always some plus side to it." James Downey, writer. Certainly the people at the network did not like the show at all in 1993, 1994, those seasons. When the new group came together in 1995, taking myself out of it, I think that as much as innocent people were implicitly scapegoated, it was probably necessary that the word be out everywhere that, "No, no, no, they cleaned house, all the Deadwood's gone. They have a whole new cast, it's all new." Starting around 95, Saturday Night Live became very much a performer's show. There were new innovations limiting what writers could do. Writers had to write one piece for a character, and then they could write a premise piece. It was enforcing the idea that the cast isn't here to bring to life the writers' notions. The writers are there to supply material for the characters that the cast already does. That was a big shift. That's the biggest way the show has changed. It's come way back to the idea of being a performer's show that features characters. You see the same characters a lot. Writers are the people who never want to repeat stuff. If you're in a writer's meeting and your quote-unquote idea for the week is, "I think we can do another Mango," you would be groaned out of the room. Whereas performers like repeating stuff, and they don't tend to hear, "Why do you guys keep doing Cheerleaders?" When they walk down the street, they get recognized as being on the show, and by and large, the people who come up to them don't come up to them to give them shit. They come up to say, "Hey, we love the show." If someone ran an analysis of the show, I would bet if you take everything in the history of the show that's even been on 3 times, and then from that master list figure out, of the repeat characters which have racked up the most appearances on the show, I would be willing to bet that of the top 10, 7 of them would be from this last period. Things like Mango, Cheerleaders, and so on. Whereas in the entire history of the show, there were only 4 Czech Brothers pieces. There were only, I think, 7 Conehead sketches. But I promise you, there were 15 Cheerleaders. There had to be. If you said there were 18, it wouldn't surprise me.
Paula Pell, writer. I got there in 95. That was the year that a huge amount of people didn't come back from the year before, and Lorne kind of cleaned house of everything and started anew. So it was really great because we all came in together. We also didn't have any idea how to do the show. None of us had worked on the show before, and since it's such a different beast than anything else, we all had that attitude that we're just going to try everything. And it was pretty great. It almost felt like going away to college. Everyone was in all these little dorm rooms. In the hall, everyone was getting to know each other. We went out all the time. We were all fairly young. Not many people were married or had kids yet. It was sort of one of those times when everyone was on the same wavelength. Creatively, it's hard to come in and figure out what it all is. We were just going forward. We were like, screw it, and let's just try. We were all energized because everyone was thrilled to have this job. We had one meeting with Lorne where he talked about, we're going to bring it up again and get it going. I was aware, just as a viewer, that they were coming off a bad year. I knew when I first came and met Lorne, before I got hired, he talked about the fact that the show has an arc to it, and that it would come back up, a phoenix rising many times, and this was one of those times we were hoping to bring it back up. It just seemed to have a lot of fatigue, and no one was really clicking along together anymore in a creative way. So it seemed like it had a sort of natural death. And his attitude at the time was like, I've seen it happen before, and I think this is a great new cast and new writers, and I think we can do it again. It was pretty slow at first, and I remember the press at first. There'd be an article that says, Saturday Night Live is great again! And then the next week it would be, oh, I spoke too soon. Friction between Saturday Night Live and network executives continued into the second half of the 1990s, although Jim Downey was held in awe by his peers, and Norm Macdonald was Chevy Chase's favorite among all those who succeeded him in the update anchor chair. The team became the target of an essentially one-man crusade. NBC West Coast producer Don Olmeyer had earlier declared war on Downey as program producer, and got him thrown out early in 1995. Downey resurfaced thanks to artful maneuvering by Lorne Michaels, his duties limited mainly to the update segment. That was fine with him, but not with Olmeyer, who wanted him out of there, too. By the 1997-98 season, Olmeyer was even more adamant about getting rid of Macdonald. It had turned into a veritable fixation. Ironically, Macdonald had originally taken over Update with Olmeyer's implicit blessing. He'd been adamant at the time that the position not be given to an SNL veteran who had long wanted it, and was an old pro at ruffling peacock feathers, Al Franken. That had all been private, but now Olmeyer's interventions were loud and public. In the entire tumultuous history of the show, it had probably never been the focus of a more explicit conflict between the business and creative sides of the network. Nor had there been a more concentrated assault on the independence and integrity of Lorne Michaels. Insiders and outsiders alike, meanwhile, saw it as something other than a coincidence that the Downey-McDonald updates were mirthfully merciless on the topic of O.J. Simpson, that well-known unconvicted murderer about town, who'd hosted the show in its third season and, more significantly, was a longtime golf-playing crony of none other than Don Olmeyer.
James Downey. I don't think anyone needed to tell me particularly, I mean, Lorne had been telling me for 2 years now, how unhappy Don Olmeyer was with me. Olmeyer was practically putting out memos saying, "Do not ask or accept advice from this clown." Lorne was probably put in a weird bind when I was doing Update with Norm Macdonald because I know he didn't like that approach to Update. He thought it was too mean and cold and nasty. So he would have been in a strange position on principle, wanting to fight and run interference for us, even though he actually didn't like it that much more than the network did. I think I'm right about this, just from knowing him. Norm Macdonald, cast member. Me and Jim were kind of like alone at SNL, you know, especially when the new bunch came in. In many ways, they resented Jim, because he was much smarter and funnier than them. And he was like the old crew, you know what I mean? When he went over to Update, I think they would have been happier to have him gone. After Jim got fired as a producer, I think it shocked the new establishment there that I wanted him to come to do Update with me. It was weird for everybody. Jim liked just doing Update, because we figured it wasn't that important to the show, you know, and we could just do whatever and they'd leave us alone. I didn't even want to go to dress rehearsal, because I didn't care about the audience reaction at all. It would have been fine with me if we'd never rehearsed it, and I could just do the jokes that I thought were funny, because I have more faith in me and Jim than I did in any audience. I just like doing the jokes I like, and if the audience doesn't like them, then they're wrong, not me. Don Ohlmeyer, NBC executive. That was part of the problem. Not part of the problem, that was the whole problem. I think what you have there in Norm's statement is the quintessential issue. When Saturday Night Live is really good, they do care what the audience thinks. And when Saturday Night Live is not really good, they're kind of doing it for themselves and their pals. That was what I felt was the weakness of Weekend Update at that time, which was that they were doing it for themselves. There were a lot of inside references. There were times when you would go an entire update with nothing more than a titter. You can pull out the tapes. I've looked at them 10 times. And looked at them and looked at them and looked at them. Because I wanted to make sure I wasn't being an asshole in this. Chevy Chase, cast member. Norm said he didn't care if the audience laughed. What's shocking about that? That's sort of the way I felt. That as long as 6 guys on a couch behind that camera that I was looking into laughed, and I knew those guys, then I was there. One has to do that, you know, and one has to figure what's going to work and what isn't. Of all the other update guys, the one who was the funniest to me was Norm, because he just came out and said it. Perhaps that's the writing, Jim Downey and those guys writing, but it's also Norm's quality of, I don't care. You can take that too far in your life as an entertainer-performer, and maybe it would affect, in a negative way, other things that you do. I'm just suggesting that that's a quality that lends itself to being successful as an update guy and as an actor on Saturday Night Live, which is not caring whether people say you're good or not, only that you have your integrity and that you think it's good. Norm MacDonald. I said fuck one time during update. Something got caught in my throat, and I went, what the fuck was that? If I hadn't brought attention to it, I don't think anybody would have even heard it. I pointed it out because I couldn't believe I said it, although I'm usually shocked that I didn't say it. You know what I mean? It takes a lot of discipline not to say fuck. In sketches, you've got to say what's on the cards, but in update, I would do the joke and then say whatever I wanted afterwards. So when you're just talking like that, you can easily say fuck. I like to say it a lot in real life. Anyway, Ohlmeyer said it was cool. He was good about it. He said he knew I didn't do it on purpose. Ohlmeyer should have fired me then, but he was cool. As for Lorne, he left us alone for the most part. That's what I liked about Lorne. Sometimes he would say, you don't want to do a joke like that because you want to avoid a lawsuit, you know? He'd always say, you don't want to be sued. But he'd let us do the jokes, sometimes even about his friends. He has friends that are super famous and stuff. He was cool about that. I probably wouldn't let people do jokes about friends of mine. We wanted Update to be good, but we didn't think that we had to pander. If the rest of the show was pandering, then we thought we wouldn't have to. So then I started getting the sense that they were unhappy. These people don't come up and talk to you. You just get it third hand and stuff like that. Ohlmeyer and his crew thought every joke in Update should kill, and the audience should be clapping and cheering and stuff. They thought Jay Leno did that every night with his monologues, so why couldn't we do it one night for 5 minutes, where it would just be wall-to-wall laughter and applause? My response was, I hate applause. I don't like an audience applauding, because to me that's like a cheap kind of high. They kind of control you. They're like, yeah, we agree. That's all they're doing, saying they agree with your viewpoint. And while you can applaud voluntarily, you can't laugh voluntarily. You have to laugh involuntarily. So I hate when an audience applauds. I don't want to say things that an audience will agree with. I don't want to say anything that an audience already thinks. And so the thing with Update was not to do these same jokes where you said that, you know, Pat Buchanan was a Nazi, or some ridiculous thing that wasn't true, but that everyone would applaud because they'd already heard it somewhere else. Update was never a big pep rally when I was there. It was never a big party. So I think the network started going, it doesn't seem like as much fun as it should be. Don Ohlmeyer. What you had then was, you had people tuning out during Update. And that had never happened before. You never had dropout during update. Warren Littlefield, NBC Executive. I think Don wanted to exert control over Lorne in ways that Lorne didn't want to be controlled. It was a battle of wills and egos. I think Norm MacDonald ultimately was a symbol. Don just didn't get it. He didn't get Norm MacDonald. Ohlmeyer could be the 800-pound gorilla. We said, you know what? You've got to ask your kid. We'd sit in a meeting and go, Don, we disagree. It was funny. It wasn't a perfect 90 minutes, but it was funny. I don't know, maybe he was watching it alone at 11:30. It was also before Don was in rehab. Lorne Michaels. I remember one night Don and I were having dinner at Morton's in L.A., by the bar where he can smoke, and he would have his cheeseburger and his glass of milk and his four packs of Marlboros. I sat there playing with my swordfish, thinking, if he outlives me, and it turns out to be just about gene pool, I'm going to be furious about it. Fred Wolf, writer. Ohlmeyer was completely out of line. Norm MacDonald is one of the funniest guys I ever met, and Jim Downey is the funniest writer I've ever met. And so if those two guys get together and they put together Update, then I have faith that Update is a really funny thing coming from those two guys. I've been on a lot of shows that have been sort of faltering or whatever. The network decides to step in and alter the original creative vision and sort of dabble with it, and it's never worked. I've never seen them improve ratings on any show once they step in. James Downey. And the thing that used to drive the network crazy was, why does he just stare into the camera for a minute after the joke? And we did it as often as necessary for the audience to get the joke. And there'd often be a delayed reaction, because some things weren't right there on the surface. Norm MacDonald. Sometimes I would have to be in something. For a while I had to do Bob Dole. So I'd fucking have to put on some fucking mask and go do it, so that would get in the way. All I really cared about was Update. But that fucking Bob Dole, man. I wrote a couple of sketches that I thought were funny for Bob Dole to do, and then all of a sudden he's the candidate, and then I have to appear in people's fucking sketches every week on some lame premise. One thing I started hearing toward the end was, you've got to fire Jim. You know, it was almost as if, you fire Jim and everything will be cool, and you can keep going with Update. I had no interest in anything but Update. Andy Breckman, writer. I was in the studio the week after O.J. was acquitted, and there was this tension in the country, because the country was divided and it was this weird sort of thing. It was almost something that was hard to think about, especially in mixed company. You didn't know where people were coming from. And the cold opening that week on SNL, you might remember the sketch. I don't know who wrote it, and it wasn't even on paper that funny of a sketch, and in read-through it didn't kill. But the sketch was this. Tim Meadows, as O.J., is back at his old job calling the games at ABC's Monday Night Football. And the first joke of the sketch was O.J. on the field doing commentary about a play, and he's doing the thing that Madden does, where he writes on the screen, and he's joining the marks together, and eventually they spell out, I did it. And that was the first joke of the sketch. When he wrote that out, I was in 8H, and the place exploded like, I've never heard a reaction in my life like that ever. It exploded. But it wasn't just laughter, it was almost a release, like, of course he did it, you know? And thank God somebody said it out loud. And there was applause and laughter. There is no place else that could have done that. Letterman and Leno danced around it, and they were very coy about it. But there was nothing, nothing that came close. And Downey, bless his heart, he was relentless, even after the acquittal, about O.J. Don Ohlmeyer. My only concern was what I thought was best for the show. I might be wrong or full of shit, but it wasn't like I had some political agenda. The O.J. Simpson thing was over by this time. I put everybody at NBC in a very awkward position, you know. I was brought up that you don't desert somebody who's been a friend for 27 years because he's at the worst point in his life. My decision to be supportive of O.J. as a person caused a tremendous amount of grief to people at NBC, to my family, to my kids. I did it because I wasn't going to desert somebody who had been my friend for 27 years. But when the whole situation with O.J. started, I called Lorne, I called Jay Leno, and I called Conan. And I said, "Look, this is awkward, but I'm telling you, if you in any way lay off this situation out of some concern for what I might think, forget about my feelings, just what I might think. You're crazy. You have a job to do. It's the biggest story in the country right now, and you have to deal with it the way you think is best." That was the difficult part of the Norm situation, because it resurrected all the O.J. stuff again. You know, life isn't fair, but that to me was like, what does this have to do with that? Robert Wright. Anything about O.J. had an incendiary effect on Don, but Don is a very easy guy to misread. He's so blunt, but you can't necessarily read into the bluntness that he's unfair. I know it sounds contradictory. He can say something that appears to be completely arbitrary, but his actions, generally, were almost never completely arbitrary. It would be very easy and consistent to conclude that, because Norm said some things about O.J. which were inflammatory to Don, that would be a great reason to get him off the show. But I never found a lot of evidence of that in anything else. He could get very angry about people who were anti-O.J., but doing anything about it from a business standpoint was never part of the agenda. We'll never know the answer to that one. He didn't think Norm was funny, and he probably didn't think the O.J. stuff was. It was like the world against God on O.J. The enemies list was a long list. Warren Littlefield. Don knew if he ever so much as looked cross-eyed at a television set with anybody from NBC around when Jay was doing an O.J. joke, there would be a problem. Don would stay far away from any comment ever about O.J. He never took it out on Jay, and nobody got more out of O.J. Simpson than Jay Leno did. Don separated himself from saying anything to Jay, but, "You're wonderful, you're great." Norm MacDonald. I was in L.A. over Christmas. It was the Christmas that Chris Farley died. I think it was right after Christmas. And they told me that Chris had died. And then, like 3 hours later, they told me about Update. But by that point, who cared about Update? Because Chris had just died. Somebody told me Olmeyer had said, "I want two things. I want MacDonald fired, and I want a best of Chris Farley ready to go." So then we went to the funeral in Wisconsin. That was really sad. They said, "Olmeyer wants you out." I still didn't think it would happen in the middle of the season, and no one would come right out and say it. The first week back from Christmas, no one would come right out and tell me what was going on. Lorne has a hard time telling you bad stuff. I had to do Update that Saturday, so I'm like, "Am I doing it or not?" And they're like, "We don't think you are." So I said, "Somebody's got to tell me I'm fired." But nobody wanted to do it, so they said, "You can phone Olmeyer." So I had to phone Olmeyer myself. And Olmeyer was kind of surprised that I was calling him. He just thought it would be taken care of. It was kind of weird, you know? I just said, "Well, ha ha ha." He was just kind of good cheer, you know? He said, "Oh, change has got to be made, you understand." And I go, "Well, what's the problem?" And he goes, "It's just not as funny as it should be." And so then I'm like, "You don't think I'm funny?" I said, "People around here are saying it's all you, that they all want me, and it's just you that doesn't want me." And then he was kind of surprised. He goes, "Is that what they're saying? They want me to be the bad guy." Don Olmeyer. Lauren's point at the time was, "Just let it go for the rest of the season, and we'll make a change in the summer." And he probably was right. Sometimes I get too wrapped up in something that needs to be fixed, and it won't be fixed unless we address it. But the Norm thing had been an issue for me for over a year. The Olmeyer era proved to be one of the most difficult periods for Michaels. Everyone knew Olmeyer had complaints about the cast, particularly Norm MacDonald and writer Jim Downey. At one point, Michaels, hoping to protect MacDonald and buy time, tried to placate Olmeyer with the promise, "If you feel this way at the end of the season, I will make a change." But as November became December, Ohlmeyer grew increasingly angry and frustrated, calling on Michaels to set up a dinner meeting in Aspen, where both men would be spending the Christmas break. Then, a week before Christmas, Michaels received word that Chris Farley had died. The funeral would be held in Madison, Wisconsin, Farley's hometown, on the very night Michaels was scheduled to have dinner with Ohlmeyer. Michaels flew to Madison, along with cast member Tim Meadows, attended the funeral, spent time with Farley's family and friends, and flew back to Aspen in time to keep the appointment with Ohlmeyer. Although Michaels knew the dinner would be difficult, he also thought, perhaps naively, that since he had just buried a young man he truly loved, one whose death had been unfortunately drug-related, and had gone through a painful ordeal with Farley's aggrieved family, maybe Ohlmeyer would tread lightly and not be fulminating at full force. But Ohlmeyer seemed unfazed by the circumstances and in no mood to relent. He looked at Michaels and declared, "Norm's got to go." That's why the firing happened when it did, in the middle of the season. Some believed that if Michaels hadn't been so emotionally drained by Farley's death, he might have been better able to put up a fight and save McDonald. But it was not to be. Norm McDonald. I was never bitter. I always understood that Ohlmeyer could fire me, because he was the guy that owned the cameras, so that didn't bother me. Ohlmeyer seemed honest to me about it, you know, straightforward. I was always happy that SNL gave me a chance. Other comics, when they were young, wanted to be on Johnny Carson. To me, it was like that. You get to be on Saturday Night Live. It's a dream come true. And then, everything after that is not going to be as good. To me, just getting there was the thing. Warren Littlefield. Of course, myself and others said to Don, "Why are you doing this? What is the agenda? We finish out the year and make the change." I think Don felt he had to send a message, and there were times when Don just felt he had to exert executive power because he could. That public firing was probably the greatest perception ever that it wasn't Lorne's call. That was probably the toughest thing Lorne ever had to endure. Really unfortunate. Norm McDonald. So then I thought it would be funny to go on Letterman and talk about it, because I knew that Letterman had been fired from NBC and stuff like that. I got fired on a Monday, so I called up the people at Letterman and said, "Hey, you should have me on, because I got fired. It would be funny if I just said on the show that I got fired, you know?" And so they booked me, and I went on. I told Lorne that I'd already been booked on Letterman, and could I still do it? And maybe I shouldn't do it. And he said, "Go ahead, do it." I didn't tell him that I had done it on purpose. And I remember Letterman during a break goes, "This is like some Andy Kaufman thing with fake wrestling, right?" And I go, "No, no, it's serious." Like he thought it was just a gag. Then the next day there was like some big reaction at SNL. All of a sudden people didn't want me to get fired, because they saw it as some sort of a big network president against the little guy. So then they pretended like they liked me the whole time. Lorne was trying to figure out what to do, because he didn't want it to look like he'd lost control of the show or the network was making decisions for him. After that, I just tried to get off the show. Ohlmeyer wouldn't let me off. He just wanted me not to do update and do, like, sketches or whatever. I didn't want to do sketches. So everybody's kind of embarrassed about the whole situation. They just want you gone. But Lorne had always told me, in the show, you have to have an exit strategy. Which is a way to leave the show and exactly the right way to move on in show business. So I guess after I got fired, my idea was to have an exit strategy, to get out of there without just slinking away after getting fired. And that worked to some extent, in the sense that it gave me a little bit of publicity, which is sort of currency in show business. Tim Herlihy, writer. I'm very good friends with Norm, and very good friends with Colin Quinn. So it was tough making that update transition. It was like right around the time Chris Farley died, that first week that we were trying to put together Weekend Update with Colin, wondering whether Norm was going to show up or whether it was all going to reverse. We kind of had to plow into it, and put together a whole new set and a whole new everything and try and get Colin ready. "They're going to fire Norm. They're going to fire Norm." And you know this had been going on for weeks and weeks. And all of a sudden they fired Norm. We just kind of couldn't believe it. There was a real sense of disbelief, and there was a sense that this was just the latest chess move in something that was going to go on for a long, long time. Colin Quinn, cast member. There was no inkling. Maybe some people knew and we just didn't realize it, but there was no inkling. And I think at that point I was well enough known in the show where I probably would have heard if there was some big rumor flying. I mean, sure, a couple of people knew. But there was no inkling. And Norm had been so good about letting me do pieces on Update. Not only were me and Norm tight when shooting pool, I lived in the same building as Norm, so it's like here he is, 10 floors below, and I'm hearing this shit. What happened was they called me and told me about Norm just because we knew each other. So it's like, oh my God. But here's how I felt. I felt horrible that it wasn't going to be Norm, but, and I even said it to Lorne when I met Lorne after that, if it's not Norm, I'm not going to stand here and say I don't want it, because I don't want some other guy from outside who I don't think is fucking funny to take the job just because I was being respectful of Norm. And I think Norm felt the same way. Norm was such an ally of mine, getting all my Update features on that, in a way, he had a lot to do with the fact that I would be the guy to take over for him. Huge whore, he would say that a lot. And in that Canadian accent of his, it's perfect. Yeah, he's a funny fucking bastard. Huge whore. You know, if there's one criticism of him, it is that he should have used that on more people. In retrospect, I could imagine how people would be like, Quinn's not ready for Update. But part of being a comedian is the delusion that you should be on stage at all times. Comedians could watch, like, Robin Williams and Chris Rock go on and the whole audience go crazy, and the whole time, I know what they're thinking, even the youngest new guys. I should come to work this crowd. I'm telling you, I could kill right now. That's how comedians think. I see the young guys looking at me like, move over, you had a nice run, beat it. Lorne Michaels. Don's not stupid. Don's not even evil. But Don is like the greatest high school football coach ever. He'll beat you to within an inch of your life, and he'll force you to do things. But he won't abandon you. I don't think Conan O'Brien would have stayed on the air if not for Don Olmeyer. Colin Quinn's reign as Update anchor was relatively short-lived. When the show returned for a new season in the fall of 2000, head writer Tina Fey and cast member Jimmy Fallon took over Update and made it a showpiece again. It was no longer a parody of a newscast. Now it was just a sexy pair of smart alecks sitting around and making fun of the world. One critic, leveling presumably the ultimate compliment, said that when at their most ruthless, Fey and Fallon summon up the finest spirit of Belushi, the anarchic, savage Belushi, the one we all want to remember most fondly in our dreams. Of course, Belushi was never an Update anchor, though he did appear occasionally with one of his commentaries, pieces that started out on a calm and reasoned note and rapidly degenerated into hilarious tirades, ending with Belushi twirling himself off his chair and vanishing behind the Update desk. Ralph Nader, host. In general, on the weekly news Update, they bat about 275. More than one of four is really good, but there is some redeeming value to it. When the realistic freedom of dialogue and public discourse is restricted in any society, the quality of satire increases. That's why the best satire in the world in the latter half of the 20th century was in the Soviet Union, like Crocodile magazine. Our satire couldn't come close to the satire in the Soviet bloc countries because it was the only way they could get anything across. We're moving into that arena now, only it isn't the government that's doing it. It's the censorship of the monetized moguls who run the communications industry and the television radio industry. I think over time there have been a lot of stupid and gross things on Saturday Night Live, but it does get across some current events with its skits and its weekend update. That is just a reflection of the decay of our culture. When the culture decays, and the communications media decay, then something as weak as a 275 hitter on Saturday Night Live shines.
Tina Fey, cast member. I came here as a writer, I didn't expect to be on camera, but I had been performing at Second City doing 8 shows a week, and I was auditioning for other stuff outside as an actor. I never booked commercials, and I never got 2 lines on Early Edition, nothing. So I was kind of at a crossroads and thought, well, maybe I should just be a writer. I applied for this job as a writer, and kind of left it open that if I got the job, that would sort of decide for me what I was going to do for the next stretch of time. After a year or two, I did start to miss performing, so I did a 2-woman show with Rachel Dratch in Chicago one summer, and then we did it in New York all of last summer, and I also improvised all the time with the Upright Citizens Brigade down on 22nd Street. So we did our show, and I think Lorne came and saw the show last summer. Colin had said he was leaving early in the summer, and then Lorne came and saw the show. And it was Lorne's idea for me and Jimmy to test together to do Update.
Jimmy Fallon, cast member. Originally, I didn't even want to do Update. Honestly, when they asked me if I wanted to do it, I had no idea about the news or anything. I don't read. I read USA Today. That's the only thing I read, because it's got colored pictures and stuff. Now I find out the news through setups we do for jokes. I said Update wasn't my bag and didn't want to do it at all. And then Lorne kind of talked me into it, and I said, the only way I'm going to do it is to do it with 2 people, because I don't want it to be the Jimmy Fallon thing. So we look at the auditions, because a lot of the cast auditioned to be Update host. And Tina Fey's was awesome. It was great. They were going to hire some other dude, but she was just so cute and so awesome it was unbelievable. And she had a point of view that I hadn't seen on Update. So I thought it would be really cool if we both did it, and like immediately Lorne loved it. He knew it right there. He said, yes, definitely. Tina's going to be the smart, brainy girl, and you're going to be the kind of goofy guy that doesn't do his homework and asks her for answers and stuff. You know, Lorne is brilliant with that stuff. So it was like, okay, I like that. We did a test with just me, Tina, the cameramen, a director, and Lorne. And after 1 take, he would come out with, okay, relax a little bit more. And I like Tina on this side and Jim on this side. Lorne said, what we'll do is we'll do it until Christmas because it takes a long time to get into it. And if you hate it or it's not working, we can find something else.
Tina Fey. All we had from Lorne was that he wanted it to seem that we liked each other, which we do, and that the whole thing was a good time. And underneath that, I know for me, I wanted to make sure I felt that the point of view of the jokes was in keeping with, you know, if I'm reading it, my own point of view of the story. And Lorne said to not worry about it as a parody of the news so much anymore. We use that when it helps us and not worry about it when it doesn't. Because there have been so many parodies and satires of TV newscasts over the years. Jimmy and I looked at a few tapes when we were preparing our test. We did watch Chevy specifically because Lorne talked about it. It was an interesting point. He said you have to go out there with a little detachment. These are the jokes they gave me, which for me was particularly different, because a lot of times I was writing them. But it is true that to get away with it, you want that sort of playful detachment. Like, we're just out here trying to deal with this. We're not that invested in it.
Jimmy Fallon. After the first update, I was so stressed. When it was over with, I thanked Lorne. I was like, this is the coolest thing ever. It's such a rush, man. Because I'm wearing a suit, for God's sake. I don't have any suits. I don't. I've got to wear suits now. So I wear suits and talk about the White House and all that stuff. It's cool. Then De Niro came on. It's just fun. It's absolutely fun. I'm peaking soon. It's gotta peak because otherwise I'll go insane and then where are you? The way I look at it is, it's mine and Tina's little 6-minute thing. It's a theater show. If I want to talk to the audience, I'm going to. One time the applause sign didn't go on and it was just dead air. And I was like, did they not press the applause button? What's the deal? Meanwhile, on the cue card, it says, thank you, everybody. So I am not going to read the card and say, thank you, everybody, if no one clapped. Thanks for what? So instead, I just said, thanks, Tina. And no one else, apparently.
Tina Fey. We knew that Jimmy was more than charming enough for the two of us, so we'd have that.
Alec Baldwin. I would say the show's less politically wicked than it used to be. Now they make fun of people, but they don't make fun of people and make a political statement at the same time. It doesn't seem that it's as biting satirically as it was before. They should be having a field day with those two huge oil whores that we have in there now, Cheney and Bush. God, you could be just cooking them and eating them every week. I still think Tina Fey is hysterically funny, though. I think she has the perfect kind of meter and cadence for the news thing. And that's something where you do still have some of the edginess of the show. I used to not even watch the Weekend Update segment before, because I thought it was just a lot of tired LaToya Jackson jokes. Now it has some real bite to it, and I think it's because of Tina and Jimmy. They're really funny.